You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seat and tray table are in their upright and locked position. The airlock is sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. Woof. Well, what a week it's been, nerdlings. So I feel like we're traveling, not to extend the metaphor to the point of absurdity here, but I feel like we really are traveling to a completely different universe because our last guest was Helene Wecker and we were doing historical fantasy and the rootedness of this all really happened, but we never knew that it happened, and historical fantasy that is very leaning hard into the truth of history, into far-flung and wildly speculative futures with Becky Chambers. Becky, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
That was kind of a long intro into a small, funny podcast.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it
I
is.
I see what you did there.
Yes. Got it here. I mean, I think you probably have had to endure a little bit of ribbing because that sort of comes along with being the Hugo Award winner for best series for Wayfarers. Did they make you wear the funny hat? Like, did you do the loser's party thing and the whole thing?
I did have to wear a funny hat. I did wear a funny hat. And I appreciated the funny hat very much. So I will wear a funny hat anytime, regardless of whether or not a Hugo is involved.
Did you also wear the pins all weekend? The little rocket pin?
I did wear the rocket pin.
I got yelled at because I kept them in the bag because I said they were mint, unopened. And Mer Lafferty yelled at me and said, "That's not how it works. Go fucking get them and put them fucking on."
That's correct. You got to wear your rocket.
Yeah. I'm the only non-Hugo nominee / non-Hugo winner in this podcast at this point. So as the remaining 33% of mediocrity, let me just say that as the representative of every man, as it were, this is definitely a sort of like, oh, nice problem to have. Mint condition Hugo.
I will tell you from the side of podcasting, and being an author, you know, trying to get out there, that is the height of imposter syndrome right there.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't fucking belong here. I'm in a party with Chuck Wendig and George R. R. Martin and Neil freaking Sandman Gaiman.
Yeah, that one.
And it's like, I'm not supposed to be in this room. There's no freaking way I'm supposed to be in this room.
See, that's the thing, though, that I love about Worldcon is we all are supposed to be in that room. Everybody's supposed to be in that room together. And that's the thing I like so much about it.
Well, yeah. I think I've never had the opportunity to go to a Worldcon before. And I should revise that. Of course I've had the opportunity. It's like, it's there. It's a thing that happened. Well, no. And the reason why I have not gone is pretty simple. With the exception of this year's Worldcon being shifted to December, Worldcon is always the literal actual first week that my school opens.
Yeah.
And so since my actual job that pays actual bills expects me to be there during the first week, it's a little hard to be like, I'm going to go bop and hang out with my nerd people. Peace. But honestly, the great thing about not just Worldcon, but theoretically, at least any convention should be that whatever your imposter syndrome status is, everybody who's in that room was somebody who felt like they didn't belong in any room. Because that's so much of what so much of what is both good and unfortunately sometimes toxic about geek culture is sort of built out of that hunger for belonging and that desire to like feeling like you were always gatekept from sort of other people's worlds, which unfortunately sometimes backlashes into our own sort of performative gatekeeping. But I think at its best, it's a collection of people who were outsiders, who are looking to create this giant different inside.
And look at you. We wouldn't be having this conversation right now if it weren't for people welcoming me in at Worldcon when I felt like I didn't fit. I went to my first Worldcon in 2014. I had just self-published The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet. And I'm very honest about this. I'm garbage at self-promotion. I wasn't really there to promote the book. I just wanted to go. And I had no idea how to talk about my work. I had no idea how to explain to people what I did. I didn't know anybody. And I just wanted to check it out, see what was there. And I didn't feel at first like this was my place. Like everybody there was buddies. There's all these big names that I'd seen that I'm just like, gosh, this isn't for me at all. And yet everybody was so warm and welcoming and there was a chair for me at every table. And that led to me getting my first book deal. The whole reason I got picked up is I went to a party and hit it off with a woman and we chatted it up and had a great time and had a few beers. And then 6 months later, she emailed me and said, by the way, I'm an editor and I read your book. Would you like a contract? So like, that's, I mean,
2014, so whenever, was that London?
That was London.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. That's awesome.
I was living in Reykjavik at the time, so it was a short hop.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I had a similar experience, except for all the, you know, publishing stuff. But we're just I went there and I was excited to go, but I met a group of people, the Ink Punks. And the Punks were, they had been a Clarion together. They had been like a Clarion group or whatever you want to call them. And they became such a close-knit community. They didn't want that to end. They really enjoyed that. And so they continued it and they became the Ink Punks and they did a lot of stuff together. They were, none of them were famous really. None of them had anything particularly going on. Some of them had some anthology kind of stuff going on, but they were very welcoming. And so I hit it off with them immediately. And was able to, it's almost like instantly having a group of people that when you go there, you can hang out with them and you always have someone to have dinner with and all this kind of stuff. And that's where I met Galen Dara, who is now a Hugo Award winning professional artist. But at the time was just sitting in a hallway with me doodling on a notepad, you know, kind of thing. So I had a very similar experience where it just felt so good to be there. And I've wanted to translate that to other people and I'm constantly telling them to go to WorldCon.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, and I guess kind of talking about the story that you just told, Becky, about how The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet found its way into Orbit's arms, you know, and then out into the rest of the world for the rest of us to see. It's Orbit, right? It's
Harper Voyager. No, Harper Voyager.
Damn it. So I crossed my wires there. But it found its way. It's found its way to Harper Voyager. Like, I think if you hadn't had the opportunity to connect with someone face to face, then it might have been a little bit more challenging to get them to embrace a book that is the whole Wayfarers series, but particularly the first book, is sort of like, what if space opera were actually vibes?
Yeah.
You know, yep. It's like what if, you know, it's not no plot, but it's like, it's like, what if the vibes were actually much more important than events? And like the events exist to support our understanding of a character.
I will be the first person to tell you that if you're looking for a big crunchy plot to go read somebody else's stuff, that's not what I do. I am fully 100% interested in the characters and their daily lives and how they talk to each other, how they go about have everything, you know?
Yeah.
That, because to me, I think, I mean, this is my soapbox here, but I mean, that's what a podcast is for, right? So I think little stories are important and little stories are interesting. And the stories we tell each other on a day-to-day basis are usually not that important, but they're still interesting and they're still relevant and they're important to us. And I think you can expand that to a big fantastical universe full of aliens. Just because the world itself or the setting of the story is big doesn't mean you can't tell small stories within it. And that is obviously what I really like to do.
I was thinking about, because it kind of doing my homework and like noodling around a little bit and thinking about like, wow, chance to talk to Becky Chambers. I literally teach her books. What do I do with this as an opportunity? And I thought about how one of the things that shows up in your bio of yourself is that you grew up playing tabletop RPGs. And that's something I did too, like relentlessly throughout middle school and high school and into college and so on. And even now, you know, when I'm able. But I think for me, that was where I found my identity as someone who wanted to tell stories about people where stuff also happens.
Right.
And I guess I don't know if your experience with RPGs has anything to do with who you've become as a writer, but that's always something I love because lots of writers are gamers in that way.
You know, I literally had a tabletop session last night. So we are very much on the same page here. Gaming in general, be it tabletop or video games, has had a huge influence on how I not only tell stories, but think about stories. In that, yeah, I love role-playing games. They are my catnip forever. And all of those stories, even if they are ostensibly about, you know, we got to go save the world again. We got to go, you know, stop the interdimensional void from swallowing the whatever it is this week. You know,
what's
about
the plural. What's the plural for apocalypse?
Apocalypse. Oh, I don't know. I'm not going to try. I shouldn't have started.
But the only reason you care about the multiple apocalypses,
apocalypse. Should we do like a Latin thing with this? Apocalypse
of the worlds.
The endses
of the worlds. The reason you care about that is because of the characters, because of these little people who have been living in your head for months or years. The campaign I played last night, we've been at it for 6 years now.
Oh, wow.
And those people are just friends at this point, you know? Yeah. I'm literally playing with my friends, but the people who live in my head, they're my friends. And I also, I write stories with my role-playing group a lot. We write stories just for each other about our characters, and I jokingly refer to it as off-season training, but it's not a joke. Like, it when I get stuck in my work, I often find, this is a little bit of a sidebar, but I promise it's relevant, people, when they ask, you know, what do you do about writer's block, what do you do when you don't feel like writing, I think the best thing to do is to continue writing, but do something else, write something that is not the project you're stuck on. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it tends to be stories about my tabletop characters. Like, that works. I'm still exercising the same muscle, but I'm doing so in a no pressure sort of way. So yeah, tabletop gaming, RPGs, they are all in there in my work for sure.
I used to do that with my World of Warcraft characters.
Mm-hmm.
I'd post on the Earthen Ring forums and post little stories because I found out other people were doing it. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And so I would write these little short stories about my characters running around Azeroth. And because when you're playing on a server, you can have multiple characters, but those characters can never interact because you can only play one character at a time. But in my stories, they could interact.
Right, yeah.
And build this frame and it was all about family with them. The main character was the uncle, and he kind of adopted all these other characters, and he was not a good uncle, but everybody loved him anyway.
Well, so I have an important question for you. Yes. Now, which is, when you were playing WoW, did you have quote unquote a house? Like, this is, I understand they've added like bases and stuff. I stopped playing after Wrath, so this is before my time. But I had a particular house in Darnassus where I would put my character to sleep.
Yes.
At the end of the day, like, it wasn't, you know, it was just background environment, but I decided that was her house and that was her bed, and you know, it was important to me. Yeah.
Yeah, we had something like that. It was an Orgrimmar, because you know, for the Horde.
Sure, sure.
And but it was in Orgrimmar, and it was this I remember you had to go up, and then you went around, and then you went up this little staircase, and there was like this little lab, and there was nothing there.
Right.
There was nothing to it, but that was one spot that our guild would meet all the time, and we were all role players. So we were always, not always in character, but most of the time we were in character. And it was funny because you'd be running along as fast as you could, right? You're just running, and then as you're running, you're changing your outfit. So you can get up there, and then you stop suddenly, and you very slowly walk in, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you couldn't run while role playing. That's just impolite.
No. Yeah. And we had the there was an add-on you could get at the time that added stuff to your character that people could see if they had the add-on. So you could add like a last name, you could add a character bio.
Oh, I had that too. Yeah, I forgot all about that. Yeah.
And with a button you could switch your outfit, which was really cool. You could have different outfits. So you had your battle outfit and then you had your RP outfit.
Right. Yes.
And you just switch them really quick. Yeah. We did all that crap.
Yeah.
But to your point, you mentioned having been in this game for 6 years. I remember there was a different guild. I cannot remember the name of them right now, but they were serious. They were never out of character.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. And one of there was like an incident where someone outside the guild killed a character inside the guild. And there was a huge debate going on about, do I keep my character dead? My level 60, fully tricked out character that I've spent all this time on. Like, it was a huge deal. It's a huge deal.
Yeah. I mean, you put little pieces of yourself in those characters, right? Like,
yep.
I just told my GM last night, he was joking around about something very dangerous we're about to do. And he's like, do you have another character in the pipeline? And I said, I'll smother you in your sleep. So, no, I mean, because it's important, right? Like whenever we're, you can laugh it off as, oh, it's just a video game. Oh, it's just a campaign, whatever. It's just a book. Right. Mm-hmm. But all these characters, they're little pieces of ourselves we carve off and put out into the world. And they're not necessarily things we understand at the time. You know,
yeah.
I often don't know what it is I'm writing until after I've written it, be it something just for me or my friends or something, you know, for mm-hmm. however many people read my stuff. It's stories are our way of processing ourselves and the worlds mm-hmm. around us. And so, yeah, it is a big deal when a character dies, whether it's by accident, just in a game, yeah. or whether it's something you're doing intentionally in a story, it is a big deal.
We have this sense of like justice, I think, that we build up around characters and their stories, where like they need to have a certain type of outcome, or like they need to, you know, in the case of like the level 60 guy whose character was killed off, and like, is it a break of our RP covenant with one another if I somehow bring back this character? Or, you know, do I follow it through to its logical conclusion and start with someone new because we're cleaving to that? The reason that you're torn on that is because there's that part of you that's like, no, this is a main character. This is a character I care about. Like, they're supposed to be sort of immutable. They're supposed to just continue. And I remember vividly, and I'm going to describe this in the least spoilery way possible, when I taught Long Way to a Small Angry Planet a couple of years ago with some of my students in a speculative fiction class, we got to that point mm-hmm. at the end of the novel where mm-hmm. something drastic has happened mm-hmm. and there is this rush to recover the character to whom something drastic has happened, and things turn out as they do mm-hmm. and my students were just absolutely ready to fucking riot. they were gonna flip chairs and tables.
Yeah.
They were gonna find your email address. Mm-hmm. They were ready. They were gonna take up arms against their oppressor. And so on the one hand, I was like, kids. And on the other hand, I was, oh my God, I've just been attacked by the cat and the camera just went everywhere. So now Hobbs is joining the fight. Hobbs yep. has entered the chat. But getting back on track here, like, but on the other hand, it was like, good job, Becky. Good job. Because like, you broke them and you did it because you meant to. And the reason it worked as well as it does is it was sort of encapsulated by something one of my students said. She lingered after class, the way students sometimes do, because she wanted to say something just to me. Mm-hmm. She lingered for a while and sort of waited at the you know, peripheries of things until everyone else had cleared out. And I'm like, you want to talk about this some more? And she says, I need to talk about this some more, but no, I don't need to talk about this. I just need to say something. And I'm like, okay, say the thing. And she says, it's not supposed to work that way. Like, that's not what's supposed to happen. I said, well, why do you think that? And they're like, because no story has ever done that before. Or at least what she means, of course, is no story I've ever read has done that
right.
before.
Nobody had done that. Yeah.
But I looked at this 16-year-old and I'm like, well, it might happen again.
Yeah.
What will you do then?
And on an unrelated note, here is a copy of Old Yeller.
Yes. Yeah. And while we're at it, let's return to last week's pick of the week, Death by Todd May. But yeah, I mean, just the whole idea of it was honestly them readjusting their relationship to fiction, because they realized that there's not like an implicit pact in fiction that says these guys that we start the story with, this sort of scrappy band of heroes that you're getting into and stuff, guess what? You are not guaranteed this being the same unit at the end. Like, right. It doesn't actually have to work that way.
Right. I never kill characters flippantly. Like, it's always or not. Maybe it's just something drastic that doesn't result in death. But like any sort of tragedy, any sort of trauma, it's something I approach very intentionally. But it is also something I think is important to have unfairness and to have randomness, not in a cruel way. I never want to do it in such a way where, you know,
I'm like a dartboard and like, you're going to get
exactly.
it.
Yeah. I don't want it to feel arbitrary, you know, but life is unfair and life is random and bad stuff happens. And ultimately what I am trying to write are hopeful futures and futures that feel good, right? Like, I'm like, the point is not to write a tragedy. The point is to write, here is a future that feels you know, like something you could point your compass toward. But the important thing about writing hope, I think, is that you have to deal with the rough stuff. You have to show the unfair things, because hope and rose-colored glasses are not the same thing, right? Hope doesn't mean everything works out. Hope is born out of pain and something going wrong. So it's important for me to not only show those moments, but also what happens after. People heal, people move on, people grow from it. It's still not fair and it's still not okay, but life continues. And so yeah, I never know what to say to people in those moments when they talk to me about that or other moments in the series where you know, they you know, shake their fists and gnash their teeth a little bit. And I'm like, part of me wants to apologize, but the other part of me is like, good.
I was gonna throw it out there. I've had the opportunity to talk to Kate Elliott. And there are two authors who had me basically reading their books yelling at them, because the characters were making such bad decisions and it was driving me up a wall. I'm like, oh my God. To Tracy, to your point, it's like, this is not the way the story is supposed to go. Yeah. Why are you doing this? No, don't go left. Go right. Go right. If you just go right, everything will be so much better. But no, they go left. And the two are Tad Williams with the Dragonbone chair. And then Kate Elliott with the Crown of Stars series. And I told her, I said, you had me yelling at your characters to say, why are you making these terrible decisions? Please don't do this, please. And I was just yelling at them. What do you have to say about that? She's like, good.
Yep, that's it. Exactly.
It's like she delighted in that. And so to your point, it's like, I would just say, yep. Yeah. Okay, yeah. You had a reaction. Good. You're supposed to have a reaction.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if it bounces off, where is the fun in that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not that I you know, when somebody tells me that something I read made them cry or it hurt, I don't sit there and lap up their tears, you know.
No.
Like, I do have empathy for that, because I know how that feels when you read a story and it just guts you. But if that's the intent, sometimes a story needs to. Those are the stories that stick with us, you know?
There is, and I think I'm going to tread on very thin ice here. And I think that there are certain types of listeners who I think when I talk about this, might be afraid that I'm throwing shade at YA. I'm not. I have a lot of respect for it. Because I think that there's a lot more sophisticated storytelling going on in that, you know, category of age market than people give it credit for. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's also a subculture of I will drink your tears that runs through a certain amount of YA lit that I've never fully understood from either the reader perspective of yes, make me cry the tears, or the author perspective of I will drink your tears and laugh at you sort of thing. To what extent it's like a sort of mutually agreed upon performance, or to what degree it's sort of like an authentic thing. And I think I've decided that it's veering in the performance direction, where the desire to create a really emotionally involving experience is authentic. That's the real thing. And that the writer's response of "Bwahaha, I shall drink your tears" is not actually like authentic sadism, but it's sort of like a, it's almost like a knee-jerk performative response to, it is a complicated thing to know that you've affected someone deeply. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in those situations, we say playful things, or we say sort of facetious things, because it's easier to kind of deflect than it is to kind of sit it with and process what it means for hundreds, potentially thousands of people to have encountered something and been moved by it. And so I think more and more I've seen it as like a defensive measure, like a sort of defensive kind of performance.
I do think, and I will also note that if that's the experience you're looking for, either in reading a story or writing a story, do you, like, absolutely. Yeah. Like, yeah. If that's what you're after, go for it. But I think there is definitely a degree of diffusion in there, right? Of that playfulness you described, it's sort of reminding you, this is a story, this is made up, we're all playing make believe here. But just as it's a big deal deciding whether or not to bring your character back, it hurts when bad things happen to these little people on the page. And I personally don't like to laugh at that, and I don't like to take that lightly, because you know, there have been plenty of nights I cried myself to sleep over a fictional character. Aww. You know, or just had to talk to a friend and be like this horrible thing happened, you know, I'm sitting sniffling on my phone over people who don't exist, you know, like, that's real and it affects us. And yeah, I think there is a degree of responsibility in that. Like, I never want to, not to say that everything in my stories is like, well, this happened for a reason because my universe is very fatalistic or whatever. That's not what I write at all. But like, I am cautious and careful with when I twist the knife, because I don't want it to be a punishing experience. And I don't want it to, even though I do talk about things that are unfair, I don't want you as the reader to feel like I've cheated you somehow, or that like I've, you know, I've kicked you in the shins. Maybe I want to kick you in the shins just a little bit, but not in a way where, you know, afterwards, maybe you're okay with the shin kicking. I don't want you to resent it, is what I'm getting at.
This, I apologize, just because the way my brain works, but I recently, and I posted this on social media, I saw that the television show Castle is now on Hulu. And I'm really excited because they have all 8 seasons, and I'm excited to watch about 4.5 of them because it got really bad. But it starts with something that I think is relevant. The whole series starts with, he is an author, publishes the final book in a series and kills his character that everybody loves. Mm-hmm. And so throughout the first season, if I remember correctly, like, people are constantly coming up to him and going, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You killed him. You couldn't just retire him or have him be hurt in some way and just can't go on. Like, you had to kill him. And it just reminds me of that. It's like there also sometimes comes a point where as an author, you might just simply go, I can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
Right. I've done 27 books in the series. I don't want to do 28.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I need to do something different.
Yeah.
I'm intimately aware with the feeling. I haven't done 28, but I have done 4 Wayfarers novels, and the 4th was the last one. So you just know when you're done.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just put it to bed. You know, it's time to put it to bed, rather. And I understand, I think, the impulse to kill your character in that moment, because it's kind of a death for you as well as the author. You know, you have to grieve that character. You have to let them go. And I think death is kind of an easy shorthand for that. I'm not sure I personally would do it. I think I'd like to let them retire to a nice vineyard somewhere. And you
it
know,
depends. Yeah, it just depends. Yeah, it depends on a lot of stuff. Depends on where you are in your life, where you are in your head. And there's lots of factors that go into it. But the thing that I hate is when someone introduces a character specifically to kill them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, that always bugs me. And I don't like it when that happens. It's a Hollywood trope for sure. And I'm thinking that because I just recently watched the Rob Lowe thing where it's, you know, Attack of the Hollywood Clichés, where they talk about all these things that happen. It's like, oh, we're introducing a new character. That character's going to die. It's like you just know it. And sometimes that happens in a book too. It's like someone meets someone along the road and then they kind of build up a little bit of a friendship and everything's kind of going well. And then.
Right. I will say, as a counterpoint to that, I do have a character who dies in one of the books. I will not say which. But the very first thing I wrote of that book was their death scene. That was the first thing I wrote because I knew that everything was leading to that. And so, yeah, I think this all comes back to that idea of what's fair in a story and what's expected, right? What you're describing does feel cheap sometimes, you know, and again,
depends on how it's done. It depends on how it's done.
Exactly. It's all in the execution.
Yep.
And this is not to say that I've always done it right, but you know, sometimes there are characters that are just going to die. Like that's, yeah. you know it from the jump, you know, it's going to hurt. But sometimes that's just how the story works.
So maybe we need to shift to something that's a little bit brighter. And I've got actually something that I haven't done with guests in a little while. And this was actually born of many, many months ago when Patrick's family was going through some crises and his mother was very ill. I was solo running the show for about, you know, 4 or 5 episodes or so. And I had some questions that I asked people that were sort of playful and sort of fun. And this whole thread of conversation has got me thinking back to them. So I just called up the document over here. So, okay. Are you ready, Becky Chambers? I have a couple questions for you.
I am absolutely ready. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. So you got to take a road trip from a character from one of your own books, whichever book anywhere in the course of any of your works, or we'll even throw like the Vella in there or whatnot, whatever feels good. You got to take a road trip with one character. Who's riding shotgun with you?
Jenks is riding shotgun with me. Jenks from the Long Winter's,
that's a good one.
Player.
Yeah.
For a few reasons. One is that I know he knows all the good places to eat along the way. He knows all the cool places to stop. He knows like the little roads you can turn down and there's something like really weird and cool down that way. But he's also got a practical side to him. You know, I feel like going on a road trip with Kizzy would be chaos incarnate. Like Jenks has a good head on his shoulders, and you know, if something, he can change a flat tire, and he knows when it's time to stop and find a hotel. You know, I think he's the right mix of practical but willing to be spontaneous, and he's laid back. He's not going to stress about a long trip, you know. I think he'd be and he has good music too. I think he'd be a perfect shotgun.
So to kind of tie this back to a guest that was had a few weeks back, you could go to Burning Man with him, but with many fewer regrets.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Okay. He's going to make sure that you're hydrated. There's going to be snacks. Like, you know, he's got
a little fanny pack with like a kudos in it and stuff.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Exactly. You're going to party, but you're going to feel okay in the morning.
Yeah, it'll be okay. So, all right. Also, this is probably like the second most Becky Chambers' question of all of my list of questions here. What is the reason you absolutely should, or conversely, should not be on the away team that's making first contact with an alien species?
Oh, do you mean me personally? Why?
Yes, you personally. Oh, for some reason, there's an away team. You have the chance to be on it. Why should you absolutely be there or absolutely not?
I should absolutely be there because I do not firmly believe in the idea of human superiority or the idea that the universe is intended for us. So I will come into this meeting with a very open mind and an eagerness to meet this individual exactly where they're at and figure them out. I will also note that I have an international family, and if that doesn't give you a leg up on figuring out aliens and different cultures and all the little, you know, fiddly things that go into that. I feel like I am well qualified. I've got a good resume for that. Also, I would just be bitterly, bitterly jealous if someone besides me got to do it.
Yeah, you'd just, it'd be bad. Yeah. You'd give them the old GM threat right there.
I would. Yeah. I would.
Yeah. All right. Now we've worked ourselves back up into an up place, which feels like picks of the week to me. Are we feeling it? Are we going to do it?
Totally. Sure. Yeah.
All right.
Picks of the week.
All right. Let's see. Becky, do you want to lead or do you want Patrick or me to kind of model?
I can jump right in if that's
yes,
okay.
Yes, please.
So my pick would be this book Vesper Flights by Helen MacDonald. For people out there, I tend to read a lot of nonfiction. I really like essays and I love science writing as well. And so Vesper Flights is the perfect marriage of the two. It's a collection of essays about the author's relationship to nature and how that makes her, consider the human society around her as well. She's a naturalist and just the most stunningly beautiful writing in this book. Like there were times where I was reading it aloud. My wife had her 40th birthday a few weeks ago, and we ran off to a beach house in the middle of nowhere, and I was reading this book aloud on our trip. And there were times where I would stop and like shake the book or like get frustrated with the book because it was so beautiful, because I just didn't know where to put it. I was just like, oh my god, like the wording in this book is so good, like almost angry at it. But it's stunning. It's just poetry. I mean, it's not literal poetry, but that's the way it feels. Like it, that book makes me feel the way it feels to be out in nature, the way it feels when I'm standing on a hiking trail or looking out at the ocean or seeing a weird bug. If that's the sort of experience you're into, I'd highly recommend it. It's a gorgeous
read.
That's
awesome. That's awesome. All right. So Patrick, you want to arm wrestle for it or?
No, go ahead.
That's going to work. So, okay. So we're in the same place right now, I think, Becky, because I have been reading outside of my usual wheelhouses. And one of the things that I've been reading that's longer form are some books by a science writer named Mary Roach. And Mary Roach is hilarious. One of the blurbs that she got a number of years ago for one of her books was the funniest science writer in America. And honestly, it seems accurate. It's like sort of if instead of just being full of sort of like dumb jokes and cheap shots, if you had someone with Dave Barry's wit, but an actual grasp of science and a real fascination with like genuinely bizarre niche things, if you fuse these stuff together along with the ability to just really craft a sentence to do some interesting stuff, you would have Mary Roach. So right now I'm doing something which is weird for other humans, but not weird for me because I do this all the time, where I'm reading two of her books simultaneously. And I'm just sort of like, one night I'll read a chapter of this one and one night I'll read a chapter of that one. One of them is called Gulp. And it is specifically about everything that possibly you could think of to ask about digestion and tasting things. And is it gross? Much less gross than you would think, and also like crazily informative. Like, I know all this stuff now about how dog food is made. And like, did you know that the number two flavoring ingredients that go into dog food are, not kidding you here, named cadaveres and putrescence? Because dogs and cats, the coating that's put on kibble is basically a distilled but sufficiently denatured so that our senses don't process it. Like, animal food smells a little gnarly to us, but it doesn't smell as gnarly as it smells to the animals, and they love it. But it's specifically basically all the formulas are almost the same, right? The only thing that differs is like how much cornmeal or whatever do they put in it or not. But they're coating it with a substance that is literally intended to mimic something that is just exactly dead enough. Like, they're aiming for something that's been dead for 2 days-ish, because they like things that are partially rotted. That's their ideal eating thing.
This is why they say you should not put the cat's or the dog's food next to their water source.
Mm, yeah.
Because the dead thing ruins the water. And that's why the animal won't drink the water.
Yeah, yeah.
You're supposed to keep them separate.
Yeah, I feed my pets at distinct times, so they have water out at all times, but they only get food at certain times. So that's not an issue that I have. The other book, the one that I'm jumping to when I'm not reading Gulp, also by Mary Roach, is Stiff. And it's a book that's about what do we do with cadavers? And the answer is not as straightforward as you would think. It's not just a matter of like, well, we dissect them to learn stuff about things. No, we use them as like crash test dummies, and like we test medical equipment on them, and like we use them for cosmetic. Like we literally have people who like practice dressing up folks for funerary rites by working on cadavers. And again, her whole thing, she's got a book about sex called Bonk. She's got like one word title thing. It's a very cool thing that she does. She's got one about the psychology of warfare called Grunt, and on and on and on. And so her work is wonderful. It's very readable. As much as these are weird and niche things, if you're the sort of person who just like glories in knowing random shit and being a tabernacle of useless knowledge, as I do, you will be very happy reading Mary Roach's stuff.
Very cool. Very cool. So I am completely different from both of you. I'm not reading much of anything, but I did get really ridiculously excited when I went to Mile High Con and I saw Space Catan. Mm-hmm. I did not know that Space Catan existed. Space Catan is not actually the name of the product, but it's what I call it because I'm me. I saw it and I said, "Oh my God, is that Space Catan?" And the guy says, "Yes, it's actually called." And I said, no, is that Space Catan? Yes. Like, okay, I will be back on Sunday and I will buy it because I'm not going to buy anything on the first day because I don't want to lug it around. And plus, I know that when he's packing up, he will knock $10 off of it. So I went back on Sunday and I bought Space Catan. And I now own it and it's on the shelf with all the other games I never get to play. So there you go.
Catan. Space Catan.
Exactly. It's even got little rockets. It's got little rockets, which is kind of cool.
Everybody loves a little rocket.
That's yeah. Cool. And then I guess there's pieces where like you can take a colony and a ship and you can put them together and make a colony ship and you can build another little rocket. There's all these things that go together. But anyway,
I feel like we're coming full circle. Started with Hugo's, ending with rockets. Everything is we've reached a very zen place on this podcast. And I think the only way we could really bring it to complete fulfillment is we have to tell folks where to find you and your stuff. We've got Psalm of the Wild built and its sequel is coming out in July and there's so much cool stuff.
Yeah, so you can find me in one place online. It's my website, otherscribbles.com. I'm not on social media or anything, so if you want to keep up with books I have coming out or events I'm doing online, et cetera, you can sign up for my newsletter there. And there's also, you know, plenty of info about my books and me and all that good stuff.
Nice. Thanks for being with us, Becky.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Wait, don't hit stop or next or whatever you were about to do. Unless you're listening in the car and you were about to stop at that red light, go ahead and do that. But when you get going again, don't pass that red Taurus with the bumper stickers. I just don't trust them. Now that this episode of the Functional Nerds is over, you might be wondering to yourself, self, what's next? Well, if you're looking for another podcast to listen to, we recommend Beyond the Trope. Giles and Michelle have been putting out episodes regularly for over 7 years. They have a lot of great guests, just like we do, and you can check them out over at beyondthetrope.com. They also have a Patreon with a bunch of extra content for backers, which is cool. Speaking of, we have a Patreon where we offer cool extras. You can check it out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. And hey, I'm serious. Don't pass that Taurus.